Sign up now to join Attard by registering for one of our Advanced Journalism Postgrad Info Sessions in June. Head to pg.uts.edu.
Hello and welcome to Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent and local current affairs. I'm Nadine Silver. Coming up on the show...
We found that 4.3% of pregnant women reported a history of domestic violence, and we know that's very much underreported. We know it's probably much higher.
Domestic violence occurs across all age groups and life stages, but a new report found that rather than reducing during pregnancy, expecting a child is a key risk factor for domestic violence beginning or escalating. The 10-year-long study found that almost 5% of women disclosed domestic violence to their midwife. Also coming up on the show...
I think people are naturally inclined to want to question that and also lampoon that as well, because, you know, it's quite ridiculous, really.
Posters have sprung up around Sydney, mocking the New South Wales liquor and gambling campaigns. All this and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, in his second major review into Australian education, businessman David Gonski said the country must urgently modernise its model of school education and move towards individual learning for all students. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, has urged state governments, teachers and parents to back the recommendations in Mr. Gonski's report on achieving excellence in Australian schools. The report recommends shifting to a more individualised curriculum, focusing on the maximum potential growth in learning for each student per year. But what is a growth mindset? It seems our current schooling system has been failing students on either end of the academic spectrum.
My daughter was literally told by her teacher in one class, she would say she'd finish everything quickly because she was advanced. And her teacher said, she said, you know, I've finished this, miss. And the woman said, well, rub it out and start again so you have something to do.
I've definitely seen some really high-level behavioural issues. It's just due to students that are so deeply confused and embarrassed with what's going on. They're embarrassed they're so far behind. They're confused by what's happening in class. And then that leads to disruption and we get a cycle.
And at the moment, schooling often operates in little episodic year packages rather than actually operating as a continuous process.
These are just some of the issues the Gonski 2.0 report has attempted to address. Among its many recommendations was the notion of enabling students with growth mindsets to help them perform better. So, what is a growth mindset? I chatted to Wendy Johnson, one of the 8 panel members of the review, to find out. I mean, the report defined it as a belief that you can succeed if you work hard, but from what I'm getting from you is that maybe that's not exactly the right definition.
Well, I think in terms of, it depends which bits of the report you read, but what we were really clear about is we don't want students to believe that how well they're going to do at school is a result of magic or a result of what they were born with, that it's actually you can do really well if you have the right sort of coaching, the right sort of support, the right sort of challenge, and you're prepared to put in.
Say if I'm really bad at music, like terrible, if I continue to apply the growth mindset, do you think it's possible, or is it more of like... Is there limits to it?
So we have students who put their hand up for difficult maths areas, for example, who are not good at it. And we work with them in terms of coaching them that anyone can do it with the right sort of coaching, the right learning environment and the right attitude in their own heads. In terms of you and music, Nadine, if that's the example you're using, what we would say is that if we can connect you with the right adult and give you the right sort of support experiences, that you will grow and develop. You may not become an elite performer, but you will be much better than what you are now in terms of having gone through this process.
Michael Kensington is a teacher and curriculum developer in the Northern Territory. He says the growth mindset is one of the main reasons he became a teacher, and he's adapted it to his teaching methods, describing it as holistic and transformative.
So I think growth mindset gives us a way to go back and say, if students have missed something, if a student in a year eight classroom is actually at a grade two or three level, let's use the growth mindset and focus on their growth rather than just giving them an F or a below standard and saying, bad luck, you fail.
The report categorised Australian students as having either a growth mindset or a fixed mindset, suggesting that people can only distinctly believe that they could improve in anything they pursued or that their capabilities were fixed. However, Michael doesn't seem to agree.
I think all of us recognise within ourselves, with some reflection, that we have elements of fixed and growth mindset, and it's not an either-or scenario, absolutely. It's a matter of giving students the tools they need to be successful and to grow.
While the report referenced three of her publications, it simplified the material written by Professor Carol Dweck, who first coined the term growth mindset. Her stance that the growth mindset is more of a coping strategy as opposed to a state of being was not acknowledged. Her insights portrayed the ability to have both growth and fixed mindsets, with either having advantages in different situations. Michael Kensington again.
And so students will often say, hey, I've got a real growth mindset with my footy, but I don't have a growth mindset with school. Or other students will say, I have a growth mindset in maths class because I love it and I always want to get better, but I have a really fixed mindset for English. I would like to think that any human is able to have a growth mindset. I think sometimes low socioeconomic students and people who are struggling with poverty more generally do have some additional challenges.
Successful writer Antonella Gambato-Burke grew up comfortably in Sydney's North Shore.
I was very, very aware that we were better off than a lot of other people. And that didn't bring arrogance with it, but it brought a kind of sense of safety, if you will.
Yeah.
And that enabled me to focus on things. My parents never talked about money.
That we've fallen into a system that just pushes students through regardless of their year level. I think that system works brilliantly for students who are at year level, and often that is our wealthier students at better resource schools with stable families.
Mum and dad aren't freaking out about how to pay the rent or how to pay a bill or how to pay, you know, school fees or whatever. And so that automatically puts the child ahead. In addition to which, they will generally get a higher standard of education because they'll be in a better catchment area. It's unfair in that there's just this huge economic divide between people.
The recommendations presented in the Gonski report are expected to be considered by education ministers, with a conclusion to an agreement by September this year.
We're not talking about abandoning grading,
yeah,
but we're talking about refocusing on measuring the students' growth each year, every year, and holding ourselves accountable as educators for students growing, because we know that some students do an awful lot of it and other students do very little of it.
So I'm really encouraged by that idea in the new Gonski report about moving away from this sort of conveyor belt model of each year you go up and you learn something new, regardless of whether you understood what was done last year or you have those skills.
I'm Nadine Silva and you're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. A recent study has unveiled that 4.3% of women due to give birth in Western Sydney disclosed domestic violence when asked by a midwife. The 10-year study found that pregnant women from all cultural groups are increasingly vulnerable to domestic violence. Co-author Professor Hannah Dallin from the School of Nursing and Midwifery at the University of Western Sydney says a strong model promoting continuity of care needs to be implemented in Australian hospitals to properly address the growing issue. Ellie Campbell has the story.
We found that 4.3% of pregnant women reported a history of domestic violence. And we know that's very much underreported. We know it's probably much higher. And we found that women who were born in New Zealand and in the Sudan were the most likely to report domestic violence. And we also found that women who reported domestic violence at that booking visit were more likely to have psychosocial concerns such as a higher Edinburgh depression score, thoughts of self-harm. And really quite striking was the fact that around 24% of women who reported domestic violence had already also experienced childhood abuse themselves. You know, it's a really sad but real thing that women are more likely to experience the first episode of domestic violence when pregnant, or if they've experienced it before, it's more likely to escalate.
And what do you think the implications of this research are for health practitioners dealing with pregnant women who are experiencing domestic violence?
So there's a couple of really important messages that have come out of this research. One is that we probably need to look at different ways to ask the question with different cultural groups. We noticed, for example, there was almost no reporting with Chinese and Indian women. Now, we do not believe for a moment that means there is no domestic violence. But certainly within some cultures, talking about what's considered to be family business is not appropriate and not acceptable. So we have to look at culturally appropriate ways of making women feel safe and understand the importance of getting help with this issue. The other thing is that, you know, we screen women when they very first book into a hospital. They don't know us, they don't know if they trust us. And so many women would be quite reticent to disclose something like this to a complete stranger who they met for the first time. So I think it's really important that we ask the question again. It's also really important that we're aware of some of the, I guess, flags that make us ask that question again, which are things like a history of depression and childhood abuse. A very interesting thing we found is that women having subsequent babies were more likely to disclose domestic violence than women having their first. And there's a couple of interesting things going on there. One is that, yes, domestic violence may escalate as more pregnancies occur. But the second thing that might be happening there is women are realizing the impacts on themselves and their children, and so are more likely to report it. And also they are potentially more trusting of the health services they interact with. So all of those things give us little pointers to improve how we do this, both culturally, both in frequency. And I guess the overriding message is that it is probably much more likely women are going to disclose domestic violence in continuity of care relationships where they get to know and trust a midwife through the pregnancy, and that midwife is able to pick up little signs that things are changing or things are going on and ask that question again.
And you mentioned that Maori and Sudanese women were more likely to report domestic violence in the study, but do you think there are more groups of pregnant women who are more likely to experience domestic violence, or do you think it spans across the cultural spectrum?
I think we have to be very cautious about saying there are more groups that are more groups that are more likely to have domestic violence. I think it spans across all cultures and all social groups. Yes, there are certain cultural groups, perhaps it's a little bit more overt and therefore more known about. I think that there are certain socio-demographic groups, for example, higher income groups, where there's much greater efforts made to hide it. So with the Maori women or the New Zealand women, we couldn't tell whether they were Maori or not, but we do know there's an increased incidence of domestic violence within Maori populations reported in New Zealand. With the Sudanese women, we also know that women are exposed to enormous amounts of violence within that country and often prior to immigration. If you then bring, come to a foreign country and then you have all of the added stresses of that, you can see why some of those particular incidents would escalate under stressful situations. But, you know, I'm very concerned that we had, you know, virtually no reporting in Indian and Chinese women. And we know absolutely, for example, from India, we know domestic violence is high within that culture. It's very unlikely that on arrival in Australia that completely disappears.
You did mention that the study found that only 4.3% of pregnant women due to give birth reported domestic violence. And do you think that these figures are reliable? And what are some other reasons why pregnant women are reluctant to talk about it and disclose this to health practitioners?
I think the figures are vastly underrepresented, and we know that because when we do survey studies where they're anonymous and women are asked to disclose, it's much, much higher. So it is underrepresented. I think many women are quite surprised to be asked these series of questions on their very first visit with a health professional, which is probably one of the reasons why there isn't that trust there and they may not disclose. I think women are also very concerned about having their children removed, and they feel that if they disclose a violent household, that they may have their children removed. So those are things we have to really address and work with women. Certainly if the household is incredibly violent and the children are going to be at risk, there will have to be steps put in place to protect the children. But there are many other steps in place before that that we can work with women on.
And do you think that pregnant women are more vulnerable to domestic violence than women who are not pregnant?
We know that's an absolute fact. We know that domestic violence often commences during the first pregnancy. We know that if domestic violence has commenced, it often escalates during pregnancies. There is a vulnerability. We know that women are going to be growing a baby and be focusing their intentions inwards. And we know that sometimes this causes men to feel very threatened and out of control. And now we have to remember, domestic violence is not about men who've got an anger problem. Domestic violence is about power and control. And it's about men and sometimes women. Let's be really clear, the majority majority of domestic violence is men perpetrating it against women, but there is, of course, same-sex violence and there are other types of violence. But it is simply about power and control. And when a woman is pregnant and becoming very absorbed in her pregnancy and her new baby, this can threaten men's feelings around their power and control of a situation.
What do you think, as a result, now that the study's been published, it was done over 10 years, what changes do you think need to be effected in the system to effectively address this problem?
I think we need to expand continuity of care models, urgently. We have so much evidence of the benefits of those. Continuity of midwifery care, it reduces intervention, it reduces the numbers of babies dying, it reduces preterm birth, it increases satisfaction, increases breastfeeding, it impacts on postnatal mental health. There are so many reasons why it is a safer model of care. But also, if you learn to trust your midwife, and your midwife also is in tune to changes within you, this is going to be much more likely to be picked up and dealt with appropriately. So that is, I think, the first crucial thing. The second thing is, I think we are still not skilled enough in how we do it. I still see midwives asking the question and still staring at a computer screen and not doing it appropriately with a woman. And I think we need to ask the question more than once. And I think we need to really recognize these other flags that should bring us back to ask, is something going on? And be aware. So a woman who has repeated admissions, for example, of bleeding or threatened preterm labor into hospital, it should be a flag. We should be aware. It may not be domestic violence, but we now know that there's a higher chance that may be behind it.
Professor Hannah Dallin from the School of Nursing and Midwifery at the University of Western Sydney ending that report by Ellie Campbell. If you or anyone you know is experiencing family or domestic violence, please call the National Sexual Assault, Family and Domestic Violence line at 1800 737 732 or Lifeline at 13 11 14.
Razor's Edge, Sydney's independent news and current affairs radio on 2SER 107.3.
You are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. I'm Nadine Silva. With Sydney's nightlife slowly decreasing, protest posters have begun to appear down Oxford Street. The posters satirise New South Wales liquor and gambling policing ads and mock the increasing police enforcement over minute offences. Siobhan Fahey has more.
In April, the posters were found around Oxford Street spoofing New South Wales liquor and gambling ads. Why are we seeing satirical protest posters like this placed around the city?
Look, I think people are really feeling the pinch, I mean, I think one of the reasons why our campaign, Keep Sydney Open, has had so much support is because they can feel in a really palpable way the fact that they feel less free and less able to do as they please and have fun at night without hurting anybody than they do in other cities. So I think people are naturally inclined to want to question that and also lampoon that as well, because, you know, it's quite ridiculous, really. I mean, people get told where to stand, where you can and can't eat, where you can and can't smoke, you know, these kinds of things, which should be so simple, you know, having a good time with friends, are made so difficult in Sydney, New South Wales.
Yeah, so do you believe that since lockout laws were enforced, policing has increased, resulting in a lack of nightlife in Sydney?
Yeah, look, there's definitely a lack of nightlife in the centre of Sydney. It's still there if you find it, but it definitely feels a lot more constrained. But look, a lot of these problems actually date back before the lockouts, really. If we're being honest, the police in New South Wales have always been pretty zealous with policing and stopping people, sniffer dogs at train stations, and also just doing walkthroughs when people are just trying to have dinner at pubs. So, you know, we have a policing style in New South Wales. It's actually really out of touch. And a lot of people are questioning whether it's the best use of their taxpayer dollars. And also post-lockouts as well, what the trend that we're seeing is that because quite a few venues have closed down, a lot of the ones that are still operating are being harassed even more often by licensing police and by sniffer dogs. And also because there are so few venues, we're hearing from restaurant operators that they're being hassled by licensing police as well, and they're having cash registers confiscated, and they're being accused of operating as a bar just simply because patrons choose to have a bottle of wine after they've finished their meal. You know, things like that, which is just completely absurd and unheard of in other cities around the world.
And we had Sydney's Transport trying to defend the nightlife by creating what was described as being a cringy campaign and ad, which was showing something that wasn't reflective of what Sydney's real nightlife could be. It was more based around families. So why is this an inaccurate representation of the nightlife that we should be having in Sydney?
Sure. Well, look, there's no question that nightlife should be inclusive. It should be open to families. It should be open to individuals of all ages, both locals and visitors. Now, that ad campaign, which was lampooned and pretty much went viral, everybody's familiar with that pathetic ad campaign, it's important to note that it was put in place to try and support the businesses, knowing that George Street was going to be completely shredded and that less people would be coming in as a result of the light rail work. But that being said, I mean, if they really wanted to entice and encourage people to come into the city, then rather than just focusing on milkshakes and arcade games, I mean, like, you know, this just strikes to the heart of what people feel so outraged about, which is that the New South Wales government pretends that adults and adult entertainment in terms of just going out, having a drink, having some laughs, you know, going out dancing, listening to music, all these things that people in their 20s and 30s and up want to do. It's almost like that stuff doesn't exist. So if they really wanted to support the businesses and get people to come into the city, then why don't you reflect the things that people actually want to do, you know, and that is engage with actual culture, local musicians, local DJs, and rather than pretending that that alcohol doesn't exist and infantilizing adults as they did in that campaign.
Do you think they'll ever look at it in the perspective of that? So do you think they'll ever give that perspective of it, or would they keep it the same?
Yeah, look, I think what we're seeing at the moment is a bit of a transition. I think people are really fed up with government, with the government, with politicians, and I think there is a slight changing of the guard. You know, we're seeing something of a refresh among the City of Sydney councillors. I think the major parties even are starting to open up a bit more and realise exactly how they're holding back culture and people's lifestyles in Sydney, New South Wales. I think that the Keep Sydney Open campaign has something to do with that as well. And also, our campaign is getting stronger too. And we're very much set up to make the government realise that people want to engage with cities and major cities in a particular way. We want to do more than just hit the gym, go to work and then head home and get home delivery. You know, we want to be out on the streets. We want to eat until late. We want to shop until late. We want to go dancing. We want to see bands, you know. This is how people live, how they want to live. It's what we enjoy when we go traveling to other big cities. So we're slowly changing the conversation here. And I think that as long as people keep up the conversation in terms of making these spoof ads, supporting Keep Sydney Open, writing letters to their MPs, then we will see some change here.
That was Siobhan Fahey speaking to Tyson Coe. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. If you like the show, you can catch us again next week on Thursdays from 7:30 p.m. I'm Nadine Silva. Catch you guys later.